From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Tinder, where so many connections are made these days. Two college students meet at a bar, and it's going pretty well. They're getting along, they're having a nice time, they're laughing. But then it starts to take a turn. She starts to have suspicions. She does not want to ask because she's afraid he's given enough hints to know, but then she asks him directly, "Are you a Republican?" The answer ends the date, and that's because a growing number of Americans are not willing to date, let alone marry, someone with different political views. Now, we can lampoon this scenario all we want, but I don't think it's all that surprising. Human beings gravitate toward familiar and similar. But what about our neighborhoods? What about our friendships? What about the way we view people with different views, not just as wrong, but often as contemptible? The University of Rochester has produced a series of podcasts addressing issues related to hate, civility, the political divide, and more. And we've asked the participants in one of the recent podcasts to expand that conversation here on Connections because I really enjoyed what they're doing there, and they're nice enough to share their time with us here. So let's say hello to the participants. Joan Saab is Vice Provost of Academic Affairs and the Susan B. Anthony Professor of Art History and Visual and Cultural Studies. Welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Nice to be here, Evan.
Also with us is David Primo, the Ani and Mark Gabrielian Professor and Associate Professor of Political Science and Business Administration at the U of R. Welcome. Nice to have you back here as well.
It's great to be back. Thanks.
And welcome to Kevin Mawison, professor at the Warner School of Education. Kevin, welcome back. Nice to have you as well.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with a question, but first I want to kind of set up a foundation here because the foundation is just how polarized we are. And as you all talked about on the podcast, this is not the first time we've been kind of hyper-polarized or felt that way. But it has gotten measurably more severe in recent decades. So just to hit a few statistics to help at least firm that up. We've talked about landslide counties. 1976, Jimmy Carter wins the presidential election. 26% of Americans live in landslide counties, which are counties where the presidential winner won by 20 points or more. So it was 26% in 1976. 40 years later, it's more than 60%. That means you're just less likely to even really have neighbors who disagree with you. And as you mentioned on your podcast, there's research showing that in more recent generations, Americans won't consider dating someone from a different political party. And a tiny number of us, Pew says it's 4%, say that people from different political parties are at least fair-minded. I mean, it's amazing. We think if you're a different political party, you're clearly not being fair. And that's the foundation. So it's not that we've never been polarized before, but it is significant, really significant right now. So the question is this: what is the harm that comes from this kind of polarization in society? I'm going to start with Joan. What harm do you see?
Well, I think that the foundation of a healthy democracy is rooted in some sort of critical debate. And if, in order to have a sort of rational critical debate, one needs to respect the person with whom you're debating. And if you're siloed and you're not willing to engage or even entertain the idea of speaking to somebody who doesn't share your political or ideological sensibilities, then you're never going to get to that next step where you're going to engage in some sort of rational discourse that, as I said, is the foundation of a healthy democratic society. So I think that the stakes are actually pretty big.
Okay. Kevin?
I think one of the biggest problems with polarization is that it results in a couple of different consequences that aren't necessarily good for people or communities or schools or political discourse, one of which is sort of a shifting toward identifying the other side as a side that's not to be trusted and therefore a side to be defeated. And I think that that changes our perspectives on different people's political points of view from things that we ought to, you know, listen to and hear out and try to consider and try to make sense of, you know, to things that we should try to represent in a way that we can, you know, sort of get over on those folks or defeat those folks. You know, we've sort of sorted ourselves out in some cases of, you know, this sort of cross-cutting social and political discourse groups that would allow us to hear other points of view and to consider those points of view, which the process of considering those points of view, you know, makes us stronger and makes us better thinkers. And the kids in the schools in which I'm doing research right now on teenagers' political thinking realize this. You know, they sort of understand the tension between sorting and the stereotypes that sorting creates and the implications of sorting for, you know, our propensities to think of the other side as something that has to be defeated. And the fact that most of us really have more complex sort of political perspectives. And in some cases, a lot of folks are sort of disengaged politically and don't really have clear, consistent political perspectives. And so one of the things that I think is important to do is to put people in places, or to encourage people rather, to be in places in which they're, you know, engaging in this sort of cross-cutting political discourse, you know, that makes us better thinkers, hopefully makes us better listeners, you know, has positive outcomes in those regards.
Yeah, there is so much about getting over on your ideological opponents. Do you think owning the libs will be a college major sometime soon?
I mean, I hope not. I hope
or
not.
Or owning the conservatives.
Just ownership.
Yeah, just
ownership. General ownership.
Just ownership. David, what's the harm that you see when we're this polarized?
I think it's useful to define that term polarization a little bit more precisely, because I think social scientists think about it in two ways. So there's one kind of polarization. So that is the idea that as Democrats and as Republicans, we're farther apart on political issues in terms of our views on the issues. That's not the polarization I think that most people are concerned about. At least I'm not concerned about it. I think it's fine if we have vigorous disagreements and we're polarized in terms of the fact that we disagree vigorously on these issues. But it's the second kind of polarization that I think is pernicious, and that's what social scientists call affective polarization. And that's the idea that we think the other party's members, as you talked about during the intro, we think the other party's members are evil, are problematic, just as human beings. So they lose their essential humanity in our eyes because they're members of the opposite party. Let me read you a very, very quick quote from a piece of research that summarizes the literature in political science on this. Quote, "Democrats and Republicans both say that the other party's members are hypocritical, selfish, and close-minded." Well, it's going to be very hard to have a debate with somebody of the opposite party if your initial instinct going into that conversation is that the other person is hypocritical, selfish, and closed-minded. It's a recipe for disaster. And for this reason, Arthur Brooks, who's the outgoing president of the American Enterprise Institute, in fact, today is coming out with a book called Love Your Enemies: How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt. And one of the things he talks about is that we need to figure out a way to disagree better. And so I think once we separate out those two kinds of polarization, I think we can get to the issue of how do we solve this? How do we solve this problem? Because you might be able to solve affective polarization, but that doesn't mean we're going to agree anymore. But again, I think that's okay in a democracy.
Okay. Joan?
Yeah, I want to follow up on that and say I think that there's a tendency within this notion of effective polarization that David was just describing to see groups of people as a block without any sort of differentiation. And so that one idea or one ideology stands in for the whole. And again, this goes a long way towards erasing what David called the sort of humanity of the individuals or the individuality and the reasons that people may identify with one thing or another. There's variation. It's not, people are not all the same within the different sides. But when we treat them that way, we erase all sorts of important differences that would allow us to build upon and find common ground rather than shut the doors. So
that is where some in what the New York Times dubbed the intellectual dark web, they are constantly railing against this idea as they construct it, or at least as they perceive it, that modern identity politics has erased the possibility that individuals within groups might differ. And I think that's a little bit of a straw man, but I mean, at least I understand the construct that worries them. Does it worry you?
It does, if it's real. I mean, I think that if it's happening in the sort of intellectual dark web, that's yes. But if it's happening in our daily lives, then that worries me. I mean, there was an interesting article in The Atlantic, I think it was last week, about the most accepting place in the country. And it ends up, it's Watertown, New York. And one of the reasons that the author of this piece says that they're more accepting of political difference is because it's so small and that everybody knows one another. So they're able to see the individuals as individuals, even if they may differ across political or religious or other types of ideological lines. So, I mean, it's a very small community. They have something like 4 Rotary clubs. And I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why they're married to one another. I mean, that this community exists in this sort of way. But because people accept the individuals as individuals, I think that they're able to cross these lines. The most politically divided place is Washington, D.C. So not surprising.
But that's interesting because you wouldn't necessarily assume that a small town would be on the other side of that.
Yeah.
And that's a very interesting idea about why. What that does tell us about how our stereotypes break down when you actually get to know somebody individually. So before I get to some feedback that's already coming in on this, let me also say that just, I think it was probably a week ago, I had a weak moment. And so I go to where the best place, as my therapist always tells me, for your weak moments is Twitter. It's very productive. All good things happen there.
You need a new therapist.
Exactly. I usually end up, I think this is self-reinforcing because the therapist knows I need therapy because of Twitter. I see it now. But the bottom line is I was frustrated because there are times where listeners will say, hey, how come you didn't have this perspective on the program? How come you didn't? And people have no idea what the team that produces Connections does to try to get all perspectives at the table. And it's harder than you think. Because you know what I often hear? I often hear people say, if that person's coming on, I don't want to be on because I don't want to add legitimacy. I don't want to legitimize that as a viewpoint that's worth debating at the table. And sometimes it's literally centrist Democrats who won't come on with Democratic Socialists of America, who are now winning elections. And I'm going, sit now, it's not really working for you. Sometimes it's conservatives who will not come on with Democrats. Sometimes it's not just one or the other. It's like it's a lot of different things. And I was frustrated by this. And the response I got from the legions of Twitter was, yes, but some views are just not worth elevating for discussion. And I don't disagree with that sort of broadly speaking, but I think it's applied way too far these days. How, you know, if you elevate this, that's confirming either hate or something dangerous. And I don't want to sort of confirm hatred or avenues to hatred, et cetera, or oppression. But I think too often we hear people say, well, I'm not even going to engage with that because that legitimizes something that's bad, something that's morally bad. And I was venting a little, but a lot of people push back. So Joan, you know, it's hard to sort of generalize this because case by case is more what we'd have to do with this. But do we hear that too often that I won't even address that because that would legitimize this viewpoint, that would legitimize this point of view, this ideology, this person?
Well, hopefully not in my classroom you don't hear that, but I do think there's a tendency for people to use that as a fallback, as a way to not engage the other side. And I think that there's no reason to treat everyone as equivalents, but there's also no reason not to widen the circle and at least acknowledge things that you might think are beyond the bandwidth. So I think that that is a fallback. I've heard people say that, but I would think that to get to the next step, we'd have to find a way to at least nod towards things that we find heinous or reprehensible, but allow them to enter in, even if just to say that.
Okay. David?
I think students are actually pretty sensitive on college campuses, including on the U of R's campus, to holding views that might fall into that category to the extent that they self-censor. So, and this isn't necessarily extreme views. I'm thinking of a student who was in my office who said, you know, I have friends who are liberals, but they're afraid to express viewpoints that are not in perfect line with what they view as liberal orthodoxy for fear that they will be ostracized by their other liberal friends.
Kind of purity tested?
Purity testing. And it occurs on the right as well. And that sort of self-censorship is I think equally pernicious as much as the shouting down on college campuses that we see because we don't think the other viewpoint deserves to be heard. That has downstream effects where we see, again, students and to some extent faculty members self-censoring because they're fearful of deviating from what they perceive to be the orthodoxy on college campuses.
Kevin?
You know, the space in which I'm most interested in is in secondary schools and high schools. And I think one of the things that's important to mention relative to what's being discussed here is there's kind of a mythology in high schools and perhaps even a mythology in colleges, but also even beyond that conflict should be avoided in political discourse. When actually, you know, I think it's probably disrespect, mistrust, and an unwillingness to listen to others that should be avoided as opposed to conflict. I mean, conflict is a normal and healthy characteristic of any community. And a political classroom that avoids conflict as a primary goal probably will never really mature as a community of people who engage with each other, which goes back to this, you know, problem of saying that we should not engage with, you know, people who have perspectives that we find problematic or unpalatable. I think there's a difference between not engaging with unpalatable points of view and the commons coming together to, you know, critique and potentially call out and even marginalize perspectives that are not, you know, socially acceptable. There's a difference between those things. And I think, you know, one involves the latter involves that sort of, you know, healthy conflict where people are able to engage in these difficult conversations, as opposed to saying, I'm not going to engage in this conversation because there are some points of view out there that don't deserve airtime. Do I believe that there are points of view that don't deserve airtime? Probably, but I don't necessarily know that coming at political discourse, you know, in any circumstance where you have these sort of cross-cutting perspectives, coming at political discourse with that assumption, I think is really problematic, and it's one of those things that I think needs to be articulated as a norm, you know, in learning environments where people are discussing politics.
Some of it is just pragmatic in that let's just take the idea that some ideologies or viewpoints don't merit airtime. Just because you decide they're not going to be included in certain spheres of conversation doesn't mean they're going to go away. And I actually think that's some of what we're seeing with, you know, it's not a plurality, it's not a majority, but white nationalism is having a little bit of a heyday for a number of reasons in this country and around the world. And some of that is really repugnant, awful stuff. Some of that is understanding what happens when we bubble as people and what human nature does, and at least grappling with that. And again, not legitimizing hatred of the other, but saying, what are we going to do besides stick our fingers in our ears here? Because it's growing. That, you know. But I'm told all the time, I'm not saying here, by the way, listeners, that I'd like to sit down with white nationalists every day or even ever on this program. We do draw lines, but it's interesting to me how often people will say, well, if you have this person on there in this political party, that's the same as giving voice to Nazis, or that's the same. And it becomes a bit of a Kevin Bacon theory that gets us to Nazism. And I'm not sure that is helpful either. Yeah, go ahead, David.
One of the things I do at the University of Rochester is organize the Politics and Markets Project, which hosts events that bring people, experts from across the political spectrum, to debate issues. And I once did a panel on immigration. And I had a panelist who said, so I'm just commiserating here. I had a panelist who said, I'm not going to be on the panel because you are having somebody who is from an organization that I believe is racist and is against immigration because they're racist. And I said, okay, that's your choice. But, this person is part of a movement that is having enormous influence on immigration policy. It seems to me you'd want to rebut their perspective. Say, no, you're doing a disservice to these students by pretending that this is legitimate. And that's a real issue. Where do you draw the line? This is an organization that has a lot of influence in immigration policy that produces research. We can disagree with the research. We can say it's bad research. But unless you get those views out there, there's no way to rebut them. As a professor at the University of Chicago said, said when he was criticized for inviting Steve Bannon to campus, if you disagree with these views, you better darn well understand where these people are coming from so that you can be effective in countering them in the political realm. Otherwise, you're just flying blind.
But this is to have a little bit more fun and disagree a little, because this is a theme Joan Sobb's going to hit, which is it's much more fun when there's some disagreement. I will push back a little and say, even on my own sort of kind of process as I kind of piece this out, you know, when Twitter kicked Milo Yiannopoulos off, that did effectively work. That's a case for deplatforming. That dude is selling paintings out of his house this week. He is broke. He is beyond broke. So Milo's deplatforming did work. So I'm just kind of observing that as an indication where taking someone's voice out actually seems to have silenced him to some degree in terms of power and prestige. But I don't know. I mean,
the Milo example, I think, is a bad one. No
is it
offense.
An outlier?
Well, no, because he's a provocateur. He's not an intellectual. There's no ideas.
But there's
there.
Literally an absurd amount of people who took him somehow seriously as like a thinker.
That's a subject. Yeah, it's a whole other.
YouTube, which is another great place for really, whatever, has like a series of videos on Milo owns this person. And people think, wow, this guy is just such a great debater. People think Ben Shapiro is this great debater. They just own people, as opposed to that's not even the point of discourse. It shouldn't be just who owns somebody else. So I just thought, kind of wanted to disagree for sport. Go ahead, Joan.
I want to go back to something you said a few minutes ago about white nationalism and the sort of growth of white nationalism. I don't know that it's any more prevalent today than it was at the, you know, in the 1919s or in the 1930s or in the 1970s.
My perception is
that
it's fallen since the 60s and now it's bubbling.
Well, what we have now is the reason I don't know is because I didn't have access to it. I mean, not only because I wasn't alive, but because I wasn't going to those meetings. And now we have through things like Twitter and other forms of social media, we can see people post, and we can see things that before used to happen behind closed doors. And so I'm just thinking about Black Klansman, the movie, and you know, it's a sort of extreme example, right? So, but the idea that this African American police officer through the telephone could integrate a Klans group because he saw an ad in the newspaper. But he had to, you know, find somebody to be his stand-in. Now we don't need stand-ins because we can go onto Twitter and we can follow people and we can go to YouTube and watch these videos. Even if we don't agree, no one is keeping us out of that group. So we have access to things that we may not ever, I mean, that we would never have had access to before. So that's just an aside. But I do want to go back to what you said that I was going to say about how it's much more fun when people disagree. I think that it's not really about having fun. It's about sort of productive disagreement, being generative and being healthy. And so if everybody just sort of goes, oh, yeah, okay, sure, then again, you don't have a healthy functioning society. You have a bunch of, you know, robots who are all in step. So I think that, yes, it's more productive if you can have some sort of healthy and generative disagreement. And it can be more fun, but it can also be incredibly frustrating. So
okay, Kevin.
The sort of yang to Joan's yin about conflict being, you know, and disagreement being important is that sometimes what counts for civil dialogue, it doesn't feel particularly satisfying or intellectually honest. And I'm thinking back to a middle school classroom in another state in which I was doing some research where students had engaged in some pretty noteworthy public action to influence some plans to clean up a waste site and turn it into useful public land. And they did community surveys and they presented the results at public meetings and they pressed leaders to consider the benefits and costs of particular kinds of land use in some pretty sophisticated ways. And then they followed up with those leaders who responded to their work in a very civil way, in a congratulatory manner. You know, great work, kids. Thanks for your feedback. We're taking all perspectives into consideration. And after a while, some of the students began to sort of conceptualize this idea of, you know, getting the brush off from our elected leaders as the primary outcome of civic participation, which was really problematic. And I mean, some were happy that they were getting letters, but others wanted, you know, some more honest dialogue and frankly, some accountability. So, you know, I'm speculating a bit here, but I'm also guessing that there are quite a few adults who conceptualize interactions with the people that represent them and other other political actors in society similarly, you know, being cordial and civil and but not necessarily consequential. I mean, I'm not saying that civility and impact are exclusive of each other, but, you know, conflict is often a key component of pressing for change. So I guess sort of a hypothetical follow-up question for me is, you know, what differentiates from civil conflict from uncivil conflict, when sometimes, you know, sometimes civility is great, but it actually isn't all that productive. It doesn't do a whole lot.
In the same way as you talked in your podcast about this notion of either bipartisanship or cooperation or centrism or whatever you want to call it, as being, sometimes we fetishize this idea, well, this must be bipartisan, then we can feel good about it. When number one, bipartisanship hasn't gotten anything done in Washington in a long time, but number two, it doesn't automatically mean better policy or better ideas. Sometimes it's worse. Sometimes one side just has a bad idea. I mean, to me, all of this is sort of layered with what we do every day on this program, and I'm really glad our guests from the University of Rochester did this podcast, and they've got me all fired up. So why don't I just pause and let our callers jump in here for a second. Andrew and Irondequoit first. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hi, you guys. I think part of your problem, I see it as a lot of people are being called racist that aren't racist. People care about money, okay? And they're religious people, too, and they don't hate anybody, but they just don't go with this, the labels that you guys put on them. They're not racist. They're not haters. They, you know, they care about the crisis at the border, but, you know, they want a country that has a like other countries, has a regulated border, not just a free-for-all. And it's about money. And you guys, you say, oh, well, you're a hater, you're a racist, you're this, you're that, you're bigoted against this and that. They're just regular people. And you guys have hyped up so much stuff, like the world is going to end in 12 years. Are you kidding me? It's you guys got to calm down the stuff. And plus, you got to also recognize that there's enemies of this country that are filling up the social media. And I thank God I don't have a computer.
I'm
or
with
a
you
cell
there.
Phone.
I'm with you there, Andrew.
And do you know about that record store owner in Illinois that was he was selling all that white nationalist records? Do you know that story, Evan?
I don't.
You should hear about that guy, because he started selling different records, and all these other people started coming in, and it was the record store owner in Illinois. He was a white nationalist, and then he started selling other kinds of records besides that white nationalist crap, and some other people came into his store, Jamaicans and all this stuff, and he fell in love with them, and he renounced his white race, white nationalist crap, and he's a big advocate now. He tours the country and he tells people about how to calm down all this crap.
Okay.
Nice show.
Always good to have you call the program. Thank you, Andrew. So there's a couple things there. Only because he mentioned it, and it's a little bit of a kind of bothers me. Hyperbole often doesn't help in discourse either. And one of the examples is, you know, Andrew is a little bit less on the Green New Deal train, having spoken to Andrew before. But Andrew, most people are not saying the world's going to end in 2030. And when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez echoes what younger generations think, what she's really saying is, we've got about a decade, according to the science, to change our emissions habits, or we're in real, real trouble. The world doesn't automatically end on January 1st, 2030, but I agree with you that the hyperbole doesn't help. It is not hyperbole to acknowledge that science says we've got until roughly then to change our energy habits. That is true, otherwise we're going to do irreparable harm. Human beings are going to be here for a long time. It's going to be a lot less pleasant for our future generation. Now, the rest of the stuff, I'll let our guest kind of weigh in. He sees not only hyperbole, but also instantly calling someone racist or bigoted, et cetera, to the point where it's thrown around and becomes, in his eyes, meaningless. Joan?
Well, building on your comment about hyperbole, I don't think any of us have called anyone racist in this podcast. What we've been talking about is the need for healthy disagreement. But I do think, personally, that if somebody is being racist, it's okay to call them out on it to further discussion, so that we avoid the sort of sorting that Kevin was talking about, or the sort of effective dissonance that David was talking about. So I do think that I think you're right about the sort of way that hyperbole or sort of name-calling works. It shuts down any kind of productive conversation.
Okay. David?
Going to the caller's point about immigration, I do think it's important to acknowledge that there are many on the left and even many libertarians who say that those who support President Trump or his immigration policies are racist, that the reason they do it is racist. But if you actually go and look at the data, there's really, for many of these individuals, there's an economic rationale. And I think that's what the caller was getting at, that there is an economic rationale. There's an economic fear there. Now, whether it's justified or not may not be, is open to debate. But even, for instance, our battles on trade with China, it's very easy to say, it's just xenophobia. That's why, people support the president's policies on trade. But there's evidence that if you were in a district or in an area where your factory, your plant was closed because Chinese imports were more competitive, well, that's a real economic loss to you. And so to say that those individuals are racist or xenophobes or hate foreigners, I think is, again, to undertake the sort of dialogue that is going to stop debate, that it's important to try to understand where people are coming from. Now, I think Joan's correct. If ultimately you determine, okay, this person is just a racist, right, then at that point there's not much more of a conversation you can reasonably have. But I think it's important to think that shouldn't be the first place we go. The first place we go is, this person disagrees with me. They must be a racist, or they must be, going to the other side. They must just be an ultra liberal who's not thinking, who just, is a tree hugger, who doesn't care about the economy, right? You can create stereotypes on both sides, and that's where we go wrong. We need to think, how can we understand the roots of these individuals' beliefs and try to find why it is that they might, empathy, I think, is the one word, way to think about
sure.
it.
Sure. And so, Kevin, when you're feeling heated about an issue that matters deeply to you and it's someone you're having a conversation or a debate with, how do you sort of pull yourself back in the moment from ascribing really poor motives?
So one of the things that I guess I do, and I suggest through the research that I'm currently doing, that we should do in educational institutions, is to sort of help people think both about politics and metapolitics when they're doing sort of political activity together. And what I mean by metapolitics is like stepping back outside of yourself to think about how people do politics. So, you've got on the ground political discourse, and then you've got this sort of 10,000 foot view of, looking down and seeing how people are doing politics together and going, gee, isn't that interesting how they're using, particular kinds of political shortcuts in particular ways? Or, I can see that, these people are having a conversation that, involves a lot of sort of symbolic politics, symbolic ideological politics, whereas, somebody else is talking, more about sort of operational politics. And so, I think the more we can understand ourselves as political actors, and the more that we can sort of look at political activity from an analytical lens, the more we see what's happening. I think, research and motivated reasoning suggests that, sometimes we're pretty good at seeing other people doing that, engaging in motivated reasoning, which is, the process by which, new evidence around a problem comes in. And instead of reconsidering that evidence relative to your original position, that may be different from that, what that evidence suggests, you sort of ignore the evidence or reason your way around it.
You mean, for example, wherever you are politically and ideologically in this country, your view of Robert Mueller is either he's competent and solid, or he's just a dupe, a hack, and he's been bought off based on what his report's going to say.
And sometimes that changes, right? So there was a moment at which, a report had come out about something that the Mueller investigation had said that was sort of anti-Trump, and Mueller's team, released a statement saying, no, that
the,
we
the
didn't
Buzzfeed
actually...
Story,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and folks went, oh, see, there's some legitimacy to that. Whereas before, they had been sort of bashing, the Mueller investigation as sort of a partisan hit job. I mean, I think what's really important to keep in mind is that, motivated reasoning is actually a pretty common, almost natural way for people to engage in, political thinking. Like, we imagine ourselves as, these sort of scientists working our way through open-ended political problems. But, we do motivated reasoning all the time. Everybody does it. And if we understand it and acknowledge how it works, perhaps that process of understanding and acknowledging and talking about that as a sort of metapolitical act will help us do politics better. I don't know, it's kind of a hypothesis that I'm testing.
The last time I used motivated reasoning was 2013, and I was having a, I just decided, no, we all do it, you're right. There's no date where we stop. And I actually do think that there's something valuable there, even bringing that onto the table and acknowledging bias. And I think that giving a little ground can be really disarming in what feels heated. I actually did it on Twitter today when I told somebody, wow, you made a good point. You changed my view on this. And it's like, wait, I was expecting a grenade back and you offered a compliment. Well, it happens all the time when people email this program and say, Evan, how dare you X, Y, Z? And we generally write back and say, you know, yeah, thank you for that. You know, we can do better. I can do better all the time. It's disarming. And I think it's really good to acknowledge, as you said, our own natural tendency to use motivated reasoning, confirmation bias, all of these things. So let's get our only break of the hour and let's get back to your phone calls. There's so many to take here and people want to jump in with how they view these political divides, this polarization. By the way, if you want to listen to the podcast, it's outstanding that our guests have put together. We'll link to it. University of Rochester has been doing some really interesting stuff on the subjects that we've been discussing and more with our guests from the University of Rochester this hour. Joan Saab, Vice Provost of Academic Affairs, and the Susan B. Anthony Professor of Art History and Visual and Cultural Studies. David Primo, the Ani and Mark Gabrielian Professor and Associate Professor of Political Science and Business Administration. Kevin Mawison, Professor at the Warner School of Education. We're right back to your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, when Google analyzed who gets paid more or less, they found out the men collectively get paid too little, and they moved quickly to change that, which prompted questions about why many companies don't do the same when women are paid too little. We'll discuss it. In our second hour, PBS Nature, the team behind that coming to Rochester, you will meet them Wednesday on Connections. All right, Connections continues right here as we talk about political polarization, discourse, and more. Alan in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Alan.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for making this program possible.
Sure.
I wanted to go back to the issue of the damage that polarization does. And what's occurred to me recently is that we tend to be focusing on the messenger instead of the message. So if the messenger is Donald Trump and you're anti-Trump, it doesn't matter what he says, he's wrong. And vice versa. Or if you're a Republican and the Democrats propose something that's reasonable, you dismiss it out of hand. And that's dangerous because all the things your panel has said, we're not getting good information.
Yeah. So, go ahead, Alan.
Well, and then I just want to mention one other thing. Somebody talked about, I think you used the word legitimate, or one of your panelists said, if it's totally not legitimate. But every opinion is legitimate, it's a person's opinion. And even the odious ones, and by the way, my fuse gets lit quickly, so I'm not walking the walk all the time. But I think we have to train ourselves to listen to those points of view and then do our very best to understand them, which then will allow you to refute them if, in fact, they are illegitimate. So cutting off debate is just not healthy.
Alan, thank you. So I'm going to work backwards, and then I'll kick it to our guests for that. First of all, on the subject of legitimate opinions and listening at least and trying to change hearts and minds or at least be open to what people are saying. If any Connections regular listener hasn't read Unfollow by now, what are you doing? How many times do I tell you, please go read this piece in the New Yorker, the best New Yorker piece ever written about Megan Phelps Roper, the granddaughter of the founder of the Westboro Baptist Church, who only left on her own accord after someone actually took the time to listen and love her as a fellow person. And she was broken down. And that's an amazing piece on how minds can change when you think they cannot ever change. So there's that. To Alan's point, and I want to kick this to our guests here, he's saying, you know, we are making a decision on the quality or the validity of something based on who's saying it as opposed to what they're saying. And there have been all kinds of studies now. You can show voters a policy, and they'll think it's either great or terrible, but then tell them, well, that came from Obama, or that came from Mitt Romney, or that came from whoever, and their minds will change just based on who authored it. That is true, but Alan's saying it feels truer than ever. You got your hand up over there, Joan. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think that one of the things that Alan said is that all opinions are legitimate, and he's right, that everybody has the right to their own opinion, but opinions don't equal facts. And so I think that what we sometimes do is substitute, well, I think climate change isn't real, so therefore that's my opinion and it's legitimate, even though we can have all sorts of scientists showing us certain things about emissions and we can demonstrate, you know, cause and effect. And so I think that there's a tendency to treat opinion as the equivalent of sort of information or fact. And so to dismiss things as fake news or as fake when, you know, they most likely were not. And so I think that that's one of the sort of slippery concerns that I have in this particular moment.
Okay, Kevin?
Yeah, going back to, you know, Alan's point about, you know, the extent to which we attack messengers as opposed to messages, I guess my follow-up question would be, you know, why do we do that? What sort of compels people to do that? You know, and returning to sort of the point that I made earlier about the extent to which people have political shortcuts and use political shortcuts. I mean, you know, public issues are extremely complicated. Like, I can't name a single public issue area that, you know, after a few minutes sort of thinking about what that entails and the implications thereof, whether it's immigration or healthcare or gun control or what have you, you know, you get into a point where you're no longer an expert. Most people are sort of not experts in these issues, and you get there relatively quickly. And so, you know, one of the common political shortcuts that we utilize as a way of, you know, sort of standing in for, you know, that depth of understanding is to look at political elites, you know, people who, you know, are out there in the public sphere, you know, having conversations, making statements, you know, steering the conversation. And we look at those political elites and we say, yeah, I could get with that, or no, I can't get with that, or I can sort of get with that. But and so I think one of the reasons why, you know, people, you know, look at the messenger, you know, alongside the message, or sometimes, you know, instead of the message, is because the messenger is a political shortcut. Like, you know, the people who are out there, you know, making the statements and having the conversations and out in the public, you know, they represent a shortcut that most people really need to take if they're going to engage. You know, one of a number of shortcuts, but a shortcut that most people need to take if they're going to engage with, you know, public issues that are incredibly complicated.
David? No? Okay. So
I want to leave the time for the callers.
There's nothing wrong with that. And we've got more to work through. This is Rich in Rochester next. Go ahead, Rich.
So much has happened since I first called him, but the point I was going to make is that in our dialogue and stuff, I think a lot of people will use terms like I'm a centrist or an independent almost as a way to coyly not give you their opinion. But then when you unpack it, people, we all have opinions. And I think to say yourself as a centrist and an independent, I don't know if sometimes I wonder if that doesn't lend to the conversation, because we should be able to talk about the differences in the way we feel and then be able to pick, say, a position that is best for overall. And another thing, I'm of the opinion that things like compromise sometimes, to what Evan was saying, I think sometimes the compromises are more damaging than not doing anything at all. I think sometimes we put out legislation that we put so many poison pills and caveats in it, we end up twisting ourselves and doing more damage to people because of the policies that we put out. In the name of compromise.
Yeah. Okay. Rich. I mean, I think I'm sure there are times where that's true. I'm sure there are times where a compromise was the wrong call, and I take that point. I know David wants to weigh in on some of what Rich was saying there as well. Go ahead.
Starting with the first point that Rich made about independence. I see the point. You know, maybe at some point you should make a decision as to where you stand. On the other hand, it's not obvious that the bundle of positions that a traditional Democrat would hold and a traditional Republican would hold is necessarily the way we should be organizing our thoughts about issues. So you might say I'm an independent because I agree with the Democrats on issue X and I agree with the Republicans on issue Y. So being a centrist or being an independent doesn't mean that you don't have positions on issues. It just means that you don't subscribe to that whole bundle of issues that a Republican does or a Democrat does. And you can especially see this divide on social issues versus economic issues, where you might be liberal on social issues but conservative on economic issues. And it's actually pretty hard to find a party if you fall on those dimensions. And speaking to the issue of whether compromise is a positive or a negative, that's the worry I actually have about all of this talk about we all need to get along better so that we can get things done. No, I think we need to get along better as a society and in politics because that just makes us better human beings. It may not be the case, and the research is actually fairly, I think, fairly unsettled on this issue as to whether or not if we reduce affective polarization, will we actually get more done? Will we actually have less what we may call issue polarization in society? And it's not obvious that it will. But at the end of the day, when we go home, you know, after a day of politics, let's say you work on Capitol Hill, maybe you'll just feel better about yourself. And that just makes us a healthier society because we might, in some sense, potentially increase our confidence in government and our attitudes toward government if we don't believe or if we believe that at least it was a fair fight, if you will.
Okay. Well, Rick writes to us. That was Rich on the phone. Rick writes to us to say, Evan, why is it so hard just to say that there are bad people? And sometimes that's what we're dealing with. Okay, that's from Rick.
I'll say it. Sometimes there are bad people. but, you know, maybe I'm just an optimist and I feel like, and I'm an educator, so I feel like it's the role of education, public education, private education, whatever. It's the role of education to create informed and engaged citizens. And I don't know, I believe in rehabilitation. So, but you're right. Maybe there are just bad people, but I'm not willing yet to wash my hands of everyone. And
building on that point of rehabilitation and to kind of answer Rick's question, I'm really persuaded by the language of nonviolence by our friends from the Gandhi Institute on this. I think you have to leave space for redeemability for everybody. Even if we had some sort of uniform agreement on what is right and wrong, morally good and bad, it's good and evil. I think, Rick, too often we just say, well, that person's a bad person because they voted differently for me. And I understand the impulse there. We've all felt that. What I'm saying is I'm not even sure I want to label somebody a bad person, just as I'm not sure that labeling somebody, now I'm going to go down a really super Gandhi Institute hole here, but even saying someone's a racist, when someone does racist things or says racist things or enacts racist policies, because that sort of implies that it's permanent and fixed in the same way we call someone, well, that person's a criminal. Well, no, that person was convicted of a crime, but we want to have a redeemable situation for everybody. We want to have restorative opportunity for everybody. Now I'm probably sounding soft here because there are racists, so I'll just say that, okay, there are racists, but I think we're a little too quick. Maybe that's where I'm going, Kevin. You think too quick to say that person is bad, as Rick says. Just say they're bad. They're bad.
Well, the point that you made that really resonates with me is the question about how do we know people are a certain way, and at what point do we make that decision, and what are the implications thereof, right? So, you know, at what point do we say, yes, this person, fits within this category. The sort of boundaries are pretty hard and that's where they are, versus, you know, the process of sort of digging a little harder, and finding out a little bit more, sort of learning more about that person and complexifying that person a bit more. I mean, it's so in the context of the current study that I'm doing, you know, there was some conversation in one of the classrooms that I've been in about, you know, how a school and a community and a group of people are, you know, of one political persuasion or another. You know, we're all sort of pretty liberal around here. Everybody's kind of liberal around here, as if that's sort of a hard boundary. Mm-hmm. And as we get into discussions of specific issues, you know, one of the issues that we've been discussing lately is the sort of issue of, police authority relative to people's Fourth Amendment rights. Some different perspectives have emerged around, people's sort of respect for authority and people in that room, you know, sort of taking a more hierarchical position like, yeah, I mean, you know, they're, you know, the police, you know, are of a higher status with regard to, sort of engaging in the kind of work that they do because, you know, they're putting their lives on the line, which, you know, it's that those perspectives didn't necessarily fit within the boundaries that they said we are. And so, you know, one of the questions that I have is, you know, when you put boundaries around somebody or a group, you know, what happens and when do you do that?
Yeah. And just to think, if you're on the political left or if you're on the political right, you meet somebody and say, oh, well, you're a lefty or you're a righty, leaving no room for them to surprise you with actually diversity of views. And this is kind of what drives me up the wall about the way people talk about, well, the media is left. there's so many interesting things happening on the political left right now. Economic debates on policy positions, as I mentioned earlier, sort of centrist Democrats and AOC and her acolytes. It's really interesting what's happening. Just as on the political right, there's interesting diversity. And sometimes we overly compartmentalize and assume you know all there is to know about somebody. So I'll just ask you for some final thoughts here in our last minute. Give us some tools that you want us to take with us. David?
I think at the university setting, one of the things we can do is encourage students to actually engage in dialogue with people with whom they disagree. And I think that carries over into the real world. Seek out people with whom you disagree. Don't just talk to people who are going to say, yes, of course you're correct, because that's how you learn and that's how you grow. And also, I think that going back to this idea of empathy or seeking to understand where the other person is coming from, I tell my students, I teach a course in corporate strategy, and I teach my students that even if you are the stereotypical unethical executive who just cares about money, you still should care about the ethical beliefs of your consumers or of activists, because they can affect your bottom line. So the idea here is you try to understand the other person. There, obviously, there's a profit motive I'm talking about. But if you think about just in your day-to-day life to make yourself a better human being, there's some value in just understanding where the other person is coming from, because then you'll be able to sort of potentially meet them halfway or at least better understand their perspectives.
And we're taking Professor Saab's idea out the door with us everywhere we go. Everyone agreeing on everything is boring. Fair?
Fair enough.
Okay. I want to thank all of our guests for engaging and having a great discussion. You just heard David Primo, Professor Joan Saab, Kevin Maywison from the University of Rochester. Their podcast, we'll make sure that you can share it if you like. And you ought to listen, because we hit some of the themes here and they've developed other themes in different directions. Thanks to all three of you for being here. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer of Connections. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. I promise you, I am open to your critique and your criticism, and we will try to do better. And we'll listen. And we'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.